Hello and welcome to another episode of Leaders Talk. My guest today is the WHU Professor for Entrepreneurship, Dries Fams.
My main objective is actually to just have the students have a real experience about what it means to build a business model. And based on that experience, also they can come to the conclusion, this is not my thing. Yeah? And because sometimes I have a feeling that as a society, we are kind of promoting too much entrepreneurship. The likelihood that you fail is very high. And we should not pretend that it's this luxury thing. No, it's actually a shitty job. So you should only do it if you really have the ambition to do it.
Leaders Talk, the interview podcast portraying leaders who are committed to better leadership, better organizations, and a better world. Hosted by managing partner of Leadership Choices and co-founder of the Cosmic Foundation, Carsten Drath.
So with Dries, I have a discussion around the startup economy. What are the hero stories? How does he see the startup economy changing? And does he think that this is a real contribution to saving the world, or is this more greenwashing? And many more topics we'll be covering. I can say that he's a very fresh thinker. I mean, he's a scholar, obviously. He's a researcher. And he's also naturally skeptical. And this is also very refreshing to hear his perspective. So without further ado, let's dive right into the interview with Dries Fams. A very warm welcome to Professor Dries Fams. Welcome to Leaders Talk.
Carsten, thanks for inviting me. Great to be here.
Dries, what do you do? You're at WHU so far. That's known. What do you do there exactly? And who are you?
So I'm actually originally from Belgium. So I grew up in Sint-Niklaas, a city close to Antwerp. Then I went to Leuven for my bachelor studies, master studies, also did my PhD over there.
Beautiful, and, beautiful town, yeah. Beautiful university.
Indeed, yeah, it's a very nice city to live, actually. And afterwards, I went to the Netherlands, first to the Technical University of Twente, which is situated in Enschede, close to the German border. And then I stayed there for 3 years, then went to the University of Groningen, which is in the north of the Netherlands. There I stayed for 7 years. And then in 2018, I came to WHU, where I'm today the professor of innovation, entrepreneurship, and technological transformation. And I'm also the academic director of the Entrepreneurship Center and the Global Online MBA. And so, as every professor, I try to combine doing research, doing teaching, and so I also have some more administrative responsibilities.
And what was the reputation of WHU for you before you decided to join?
I have to say that outside of Germany, I would say WHU is not always that well known. And so I think within Germany, WHU is known as this private business school, very successful in terms of entrepreneurship. To be very honest, if you cross the border, it's not that a lot of people always know WHU. I knew WHU because they had some good professors and still have very good professors who are now my colleagues on the topic of innovation and entrepreneurship. So I knew already some of the colleagues there. So when I saw an opening at the university, because we started in 2018 this Master in Entrepreneurship, and because of that, they have created an opening. And I saw the advertisement, so I reached out to the colleagues at WHU saying, oh, could it be interesting for me? And they encouraged me to apply, and that's how in the end I came to WHU.
Okay. And WHU in Germany is very much connected with entrepreneurial spirit on the one hand yep. side, and then on the other hand side, it is like the go-to place if you want to make it into strategy consulting, investment banking. And I think this is more the tradition. And then the yep. startup world, that is something like of the last decade? When would you say that strong emphasis on startup economy entered WHU?
I think it's indeed something of the past 10 years. Also, we have this legacy of some very successful entrepreneurs. I think about Stefan Schubert, but of course also Oliver Zamner, that kind of kicked off this whole idea of successful entrepreneurship. They hired a lot of WAU alumni to help them in their activities. And in that way, we have started building up a network. And I think that has really manifested itself in the past 10 years.
And when we look at the startup economy, that maybe, I don't know if it started in the dot-com era, but certainly that was an important milestone.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, if we think of, I don't know, the first really big ones with, you know, selling off ringtones and stuff like that to the world that we live in now. If you were to describe the evolution of the startup economy, I know this asking a lot, but do you see like phases where like evolutionary phases?
So we, in the past like 4 years, we have built a founder database. So we are actually actively monitoring all our alumni who have founded companies, and then we also collecting data on the companies that they founded so that we can really monitor how is our ecosystem evolving over time. And then if you look indeed at kind of the industries in which WAU founders create companies, that's changing over time. So indeed, if you look at 2010 until 2017-18, e-commerce was a very dominant industry in which WAU alumni founded companies. So it's almost like they all went to Berlin to create their own e-commerce startup and become very successful. What we see in the more recently is that more and more topics like sustainability and deep tech become prominent topics for founders. And Enpal, of course, is a very famous example. So the company that rents out solar panels, was created by 3 WAU alumni. And you see, for instance, that that company now has become a kind of breeding ground and even as an inspiration for others to also create startups in that space. And also deep tech, more and more, we see that our alumni get involved into deep tech startups. So, of course, we don't see a lot of pure WAU teams creating a deep tech startup because our students are not the tech nerds. Mm-hmm. But what we actually see and what we actually also try to motivate is that we try to actually match our business-oriented students and alumni to tech teams that have created the deep tech startup, because we believe our students can really contribute to that kind of startups. And in that way, we still want to push forward the ecosystem.
And which would be university? Is that like RWTH Aachen or?
Yeah. So we have actually strong informal connections with different ones. RWTH Aachen is a quite strong connection. Also, we have Professor Brettel there, who has a strong connection with WAU. So from a legacy perspective, we intensively collaborate. But for instance, we have also created a team. So we have a WAU alumnus in the startup called Lydrotech, which has been created at the University of Bochum, for instance. And more, we are simply kind of from the Entrepreneurship Center scanning, okay, where are interesting deep tech teams and could we kind of help them by putting a WAU person in as a co-founder in the team?
Okay. So coming back to this evolution of the startup economy, is it fair to say that in the beginning, a lot of things happened kind of copying models, business models that were happening somewhere else and then trying to bring them here? And then it evolved further to e-commerce and now it's tackling more complex problems?
Yes. And I think that's, and I have nothing against this copy-paste mentality. Look, if you're great, actually, I'm always saying the value of ideas is overrated. Yeah? Successful entrepreneurs, not because they had the best idea ever. No, successful entrepreneurs are the ones that are able to perfectly execute on the idea. So if there are interesting ideas out there and you're the one who is able to perfectly execute on them, why not? As long as you don't kind of violate intellectual property and stuff like that, I think there is no issue with that. So even that for me was okay. At the same time, I think today we are in a different macroeconomic setting where this copy paste becomes inherently difficult. So now it's indeed more about finding new technologies and building on them and try to make them into a successful use cases, which is actually challenging because often the time frame to do it will be much longer than these traditional copy paste digital e-commerce business models. So this triggers some new challenges, but at least we at WAU see it as for us as an important objective to be embedded within this kind of new ecosystems that are emerging.
Yeah.
Because we think that's also the future.
Yeah. And we had a couple of WAU alumni in the podcast who have founded different kinds of businesses. And my observation would be that in the early phases, the motivation to start was more to build something, scale fast, exit, become rich, have money disposable, and then create something new with it.
Yeah.
And what I'm seeing now is more like build something, stay in there, don't necessarily exit, make it big and create an impact with that. And also, so money and becoming rich is becoming less of a primary objective. Is that too black and white, or how would you say it?
Now, Evan, I teach to my students, I teach the obligatory bachelor course entrepreneurship at WAU. And I'm always telling them, look, there are kind of two main drivers for entrepreneurs. One is the rich entrepreneur who wants to become as rich as quickly as possible. And you have the king entrepreneur who wants to kind of build his own startup and lead that forever. And I think both are just viable reasons to become an entrepreneur. And it depends a bit on you, but also the macroeconomic environment, which is the most relevant one. And like in a zero interest environment, the thing about, oh, let's build a startup, scale it up and try to sell it as quickly as possible, I think was a viable approach. Today, it is much less viable simply because of the macroeconomic environment. So also that plays a role, I would say. So I would definitely say that today, this kind of ambition of, oh, let's try to build something sexy, scale it up with VC funding and then have an exit in 1 or 2 years. I think that's a strategy that today is not very feasible, I would say.
Okay. In your humbleness, you forgot to tell us that you are also a podcast host, which I'm an avid listener of. So the WAU Awesome Founder Podcast. And there's different flavors. You have different formats in it. So there's this inspirational thing where Garrett and you meet and you bounce off ideas off each other. And what was the most interesting piece or what's the theme in this podcast for you that fascinates you most about the research about all of that?
No, so what I really like about how also the podcast is evolving over time, that we really try to bring these two perspectives in the podcast. So the one perspective is the more kind of academic perspective. What do we know actually from academic research about entrepreneurship? And that we have this more practitioner-oriented perspective, where Garrett, as a serial entrepreneur, as somebody that has been involved in coaching a lot of startups, but that also knows a bit how academic research works, so that we can bring these two different perspectives into the podcast, both when we interview entrepreneurs, but also when we do these inspiration sessions where we look more at recent academic research, recent books about entrepreneurship and try to discuss them from these two perspectives. So I think if we want to talk about a kind of unique selling point for the podcast, I think that's something that we bring on the table that I don't hear that much in other podcasts on this topic.
And I was wondering, how do you make the time? I mean, you bring in from applied psychology, from technology, deep tech, business, from the economic standpoint, you bring in all these different papers. How do you do that? How do you scan? How do you find something of interest? And how do you find the time to grind your teeth into it?
Actually, of course, as an academic scholar myself, I need to keep track of the literature. But I would also say, for instance, LinkedIn is a very good tool for that. So I simply see sometimes on my feed colleagues from other universities that announce a new paper. And sometimes then when I think, oh, this could actually be interesting for the podcast, then I check the paper out. Sometimes then we have to come to the conclusion that it's not relevant, but sometimes it is. So in that way, it's actually not that difficult to find interesting papers. So that LinkedIn is actually a very useful tool there, I would say.
Okay. And then you just have time in your day where you reserve time to read that so that you don't.
Yeah.
Wow.
And of course, that's simply part of the being an academic. You need to reserve time to read papers. And then sometimes I think, oh, this is actually a paper that is not just relevant for my research, but would also be nice to discuss on the podcast. And then we do that.
And the other day, I was teaching a class of executives the day after you had taught them on innovation. And some of them were a little bit scared that they would be out of a job in a couple of years' time. So can you explain us what you did with them?
No, I think then I definitely taught them about generative AI. So it's even a bit of kind of hobby of me now to kind of see with this whole open AI, ChatGPT that has been emerging. A lot of people have played around with it, but I think not that many people have started really thinking about, okay, what is the impact of these tools on business applications, on business activities? And I think you can already see that it can have quite some influence. So what I try to do is to simply build some prototypes of applications that at least demonstrate that, and that's at least my opinion, that how we will work in the next years will fundamentally change because of this new technology, how we write texts, how we ideate on new ideas, how we spend time on certain activities and not on other activities. I think it will fundamentally change. And I think it's important that we prepare executives and senior managers to this change so that in terms of strategizing, they can start anticipating these changes. And sometimes that also makes them a bit scared because indeed, I think some professions will fundamentally change. I think about consultants, for instance. It's very clear that a lot of time now consultants spend on doing research, on making PowerPoint slides, on communication. And you easily see that with generative AI, you will be able to automate a lot of these activities, which doesn't mean I think that consultants will become redundant, but I think what they do, how they do it, and how they build a competitive advantage will fundamentally change.
Yeah. So the entire approach to knowledge management and where do you get best practices from will be a competitive advantage that's no longer there, right? Because everybody has access to it.
Yeah. And it's the same for academics, huh? Also for my own profession. Doing a literature review, but also even doing advanced statistical analyses already today with some of the tools that you have in OpenAI, like data analysis, it's fundamentally changing. So that also triggers for me the question, okay, as an academic, how do I need to adjust my position as a researcher?
Okay. And how do you make sure that, for example, I know that you make your students use ChatGPT for your work, whereas others would say it's prohibited. You can't use it because there's no actual work that is, we cannot prove it really. So how do you use it intelligently that you know students learn something and not just copy paste?
Yeah. Now I think for my teaching, so my teaching mainly focuses on entrepreneurship. I think there it's quite easy to integrate it because generative AI is great in doing ideation, giving you ideas. It's great in storytelling, which is a very important part of entrepreneurship. So it's very clear that you can easily kind of use ChatGPT to increase the quality of what you do in terms of entrepreneurship. So what I encourage my students to do is simply, okay, they need to develop a business model with a pain point and a value proposition. So just interact with ChatGPT so that it can give you inputs, that it can give you inspiration, that you can do interviews with ChatGPT pretending that it's a customer to better understand pain points, that it can give you a 2-minute elevator pitch for when you have to pitch to mentors. So that's all quite straightforward. And so what I then do is to also show my students, okay, how do you can actually write a good prompt to increase the quality of the output that ChatGPT is generating? And then I also evaluate them on their use of ChatGPT. So they actually, when they have to hand in an assignment, they're allowed to use ChatGPT. But I also then ask them to send me an Excel with the most important prompts that they have used. Mm-hmm. And then I actually evaluate the sophistication of the prompts. So in that way, actually how they have prompted ChatGPT becomes part of the evaluation.
Okay, wow, okay. So a large part of innovation is the ideation phase.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at typical WHU students, and you literally touch every single one of them, because in the bachelor, I mean, at least in the bachelor program, they all run through your hands. I mean, every single
whether
one
they
them,
like it or not.
Whether they like it or not. They all have this class of innovation, and they don't read any books or any papers, but they have to build a business.
Yep. Yeah, so the course is structured in a way that they, in 6 weeks, they have to build their own business model and they have to pitch it at the end. During these 6 weeks, all of them do speed dating with alumni of WHU. So we actually organize a big speed dating date from 8 a.m. in the morning till 7 p.m. in the evening. We're continuously... alumni come into our Zoom, they speed date with different students, give them input on their ideas, and then the students have to use that to finalize their own business model. And so indeed, in that course, they don't have to read books or papers, but they have to listen to podcasts. So it's a kind of an alternative way. And so this course is really focused on not kind of learning by reading, but more learning by doing. Yeah? So they simply have to build their own business model. They will get feedback during the weeks from me, but also from these mentors. And in the end, even if it's only, it's like they can work on it for 7-8 weeks, there are quite some very interesting business models emerging out of it. So we always then do also competition. So I select then the best 8 teams that then have to do a live pitch in front of VC investors. And every time I have to say the VC investors are very impressed by what is coming out there. So they say, look, yeah, some of them would actually be investable cases.
Okay, but it's not that. Did anything become real out of that? I mean, like a real business?
So not from that course, but I think the problem is a bit, of course, the teams are randomly created. So you have teams of 5 students that work together. And that's always a bit of a hampering factor, because we actually know that for real entrepreneurship, also the team and how they work together is a very important aspect. So that stays a bit artificial. But for instance, I have another course called Developing Novel Business Models, which is a kind of follow-up course. So then we make it even a bit more realistic. And then we had a team that created a business called Amical. So it was a kind of job hunter platform. And later on, one of them, together with somebody else, created the platform Power Us. And that's a platform for handwerkers, so handyman. And they have now raised Series A funding. So at least the initial seeds of that were created in one of my courses. But it's also not... it's also not our objective that real startups have to emerge out of it. My main objective is actually to just have the students have a real experience about what it means to build a business model. And based on that experience, also they can come to the conclusion, this is not my thing. Yeah. And because sometimes I have a feeling that as a society, we are kind of promoting too much entrepreneurship. And I think that's not a good thing, because entrepreneurship is actually a very shitty job. The likelihood that you fail is very high. So failure is the most likely outcome of initiating a startup. And it's a very stressful activity. It's a roller coaster ride. You will not earn a lot of money in the first 5 years. And we should not pretend that it's this luxury thing. No, it's actually a shitty job. So you should only do it if you really have the ambition to do it. And so if my course makes it clear to some students that they are not fit to become entrepreneurs, that's also, for me, perfectly okay.
And here is a small announcement that might be of interest to you. As you know, we are all about better leadership, better organizations, and a better world. And in that capacity, we have founded the Cosmic Foundation. And the intention of this foundation is to give NGO leaders and their teams free access to high quality coaching, leadership development, resilience development, organizational development. And we are focusing in the first year of our kind of go-to-market, if you want to call it like that, on Ukraine as a country. We have identified two NGOs that we are going to work with. We will publish their names soon, and it would be really cool if you would support us. You can become a Cosmic Foundation ambassador by a donation of just 50 euros per year, and you'll be receiving a newsletter, regular updates on where we are standing. You have the chance to have a say, have a word on the future engagements of the organization. You can support also with your network, idealistically, if you become a Cosmic Foundation ambassador. How to do this? Simply go to our website, cosmic-foundation.org, click donate, and have an annual donation of at least 50 euros. That will make you a Cosmic Foundation ambassador automatically. And then you'll be getting our newsletter, and you'll be kept in the loop, and also ask for your input, your guidance, your advice. So if that's of interest to you, I would love to welcome you as a Cosmic Foundation ambassador going forward. And now back to the really cool conversation with Dries Bams. What I noticed, Dries, is that there is a bit of a hero story around the entrepreneur. Mm. Right? I mean, there's some stereotypes concerning the lifestyle, the 100-hour weeks, and then eventually you have this famous exit, blah, blah, blah. And there's also this notion, move fast, break things, and that you have to become big very quickly. So that size matters more than profitability, sustainability. Why is this actually?
I think it's definitely changing. So I think this mantra of move fast, break things, don't care about profitability. This was a mantra that became extremely prominent in the zero interest environment. And I think at the quick commerce startups were mainly the most kind of ultimate manifestation of that idea. I think today we are in a different macroeconomic environment. And now I think what VCs are telling the startups is also very different. Yeah? So it's, you need to become, the unit economics need to be realistic. Profitability is important. It's not just about growth. So I think the mentality has also been changing given a different macroeconomic environment.
Now, if we zoom out a little bit and look at where the world is at, I know that's that's a little big, but still, somehow having this entrepreneurial spirit, the entrepreneurial power, is probably what we need in order to survive as a species. How optimistic are you there? I mean, when I talk to especially deep tech entrepreneurs, there's a lot of optimism, like, yeah, we will solve the world's problems because, you know, of this technology and all of that. We'll kind of figure it out. How optimistic are you there?
This links a bit to this whole kind of purpose-driven entrepreneurship that has become very prominent. Yeah? Like, that's, you become an entrepreneur not to make a lot of money, but to kind of serve a purpose. But I see a lot of greenwashing there. So also, if you look, for instance, at how OpenAI presents themselves, they also present themselves as a purpose-driven company that wants to help save the world. Whereas I would say, although I'm a big kind of enthusiast of generative AI, I think OpenAI, for instance, has released these things way too soon. They have released something without understanding how it works, without having an adequate risk assessment. And I think maybe in a couple of years, we will look at 2022 when they launched ChatGPT as something that should never have happened. Yeah? So, and still they are talking about we are a purpose-driven company. So this purpose-driven entrepreneurship, I find it often a very kind of greenwashing kind of thing that I cannot do a lot with. Yeah. So I see a lot of them claiming to be purpose-driven, but then if you look at what they really do, I'm like, yeah, I don't know if you're so purpose-driven. So I'm a bit kind of skeptic about that, let's say it like that.
What about impact investing? Is that something that you find credible?
I find also there, I think there are people that do it in a credible way, and I think there are people that are abusing the label. So there are good actors, there are bad actors, like always. But yeah, if you think about this whole ESG investing, if you sometimes look at these labels, and then the worst oil companies are coming up as high in these ESG ratings, then I'm like thinking, like, what the hell are we doing? You know, this is simply kind of bureaucratization of ESG, which doesn't make any sense. So yeah, I think I see it as a very difficult topic at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for your skepticism there. I come from the coaching industry, and in the coaching industry, we have a discussion when the first artificial intelligence will be able to pass a coaching certification. You know, coaching is asking good questions, understanding context, showing empathy, having some field experience, so asking intelligent questions. What's your best guess? When would that be possible to, you know, have a credible AI coach?
I think it's already possible.
Okay.
For instance, I myself, I created my own coach where I can talk with, and that works out perfectly.
Based on ChatGPT?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So you build, you have this GPT builder nowadays, mm-hmm. where you can build your own application, where you can feed it specific knowledge. And so I just have fed that specific knowledge, and then I give it the instruction, you are now my coach, I will regularly talk with you. And then I also keep track of the talks I have with it and upload them as additional knowledge. And in that way, it also gets better over time. I think that's already what is possible.
Okay. Okay. Wow. Okay. Wow. Yeah. I have so many.
So now I scared you, not?
Okay. Wow. Mental note. We have a follow-up.
Yeah. So to be honest, I would not spend money on a coach.
Yeah.
I have my own coach. I don't have to spend money on that.
Yeah. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. now I need to recover from this one. Dries, I know that you have worked on trust, and this is something, trust in the area, and also open innovation. Can you, first of all, before we dig deeper, can you fill us in on that topic at all?
Okay. Yeah, maybe to start, I have a kind of love-hate relationship with trust, because I've done a lot of research on collaboration between companies. So how can they collaborate to jointly create innovations? That has been a kind of topic that I've studied for the past 20 years. And so, for instance, I've done a lot of case studies, meaning I just went into companies and map particular collaborations they did with other parties. And then whether I liked it or not, trust always became this big topic. And I didn't like that, because trust is, from an academic perspective, a very complex concept. So how do you need to define trust? How do you need to measure trust? If you want to do top-level research, it's very demanding. People have different opinions, so you will always be fighting with reviewers about it. So I always want to avoid it, so to talk about trust, because I know it always becomes a shit show. But in the end, the data almost forced me to talk about it, because it always emerges as this very important concept in collaborations. Yeah. So then why did something go wrong? Oh, because we didn't trust each other anymore. So trust typically comes up as an explanation of why collaborations go well and when they go sour. So building, maintaining, repairing trust in the end always emerged out of the data as a very important topic. So I was almost forced to really embed it into my academic research. And so that's a bit why I have this love-hate relationship with it.
And I've heard you talk about at least three types of trust. One was goodwill trust. One was kind of skill-based trust.
Yeah.
And the third one, I would say, systems that force you to trust each other or secures trust, like a systemic dimension on that. Can you walk us through those?
Yeah, so again, and there it becomes, that's what I mean with the complexity. So in academic research, we tend to make a distinction between different types of trust. And so one is goodwill trust. Yeah, so that means I have positive expectations that you will not screw me over. That's goodwill trust. Whereas competence trust is I have positive expectations that you have the ability to do what you promised me to do. And institutional trust is something very different. That's more like, okay, do I think there is the kind of institutional environment to do stuff in a predictable way? So that's actually on a very different level. But so you have goodwill trust and competence trust. And so it might be that I have high goodwill trust in a person and low competence trust in a person, or the other way around, that I have high competence trust and low goodwill trust. And so these things can then also change over time. Yeah? So when I would now work together with you in a coaching trajectory, for instance, and you would give me advice, and in the end, the advice turns out to be not working out, then I can start questioning your competencies. And that's typically what will happen first. If you give me advice and it doesn't work out, then initially I might start wondering, oh, does this guy really know what coaching is about? But if this persists, I might even start questioning your intentions. And I could question, oh, is this guy just trying to make money out of me and pretending to be a coach? So then I'm not only questioning your competence, but also your goodwill. And for instance, we know from research that if you have a breach in confidence in terms of competence, that's relatively easy to repair. Whereas the moment I start really questioning your intentions, it will be actually quite difficult to repair that. So the ability to repair trusts also depends on these different types of trust.
And this is relevant because you have been studying collaboration between organizations, typically between larger organizations that are already existing and newer, smaller organizations like startups, for example.
Yep.
And that were the cases that you were looking into.
Yep, indeed.
Okay. And that reminds me of a model developed by Bernhard Lieberhout, a Dutchman, together with an Austrian, Fritz Glasl, where they describe like the pioneer phase of an organization, the differentiation phase when they scale up, the integration phase where they need to become fast again because they've become too big, too much silo-driven. And then the association phase is where they learn to work together with other organizations to kind of get out of competitive mode into collaborative mode, have some smart trust. So what would be examples where you say it has worked out and maybe an example where it totally failed?
So what I've seen in my own research is that when trust is present, things go much smoother. Yeah? So when we trust each other and we face a problem, then first of all, I'm likely to attribute the problem to an external reason, not to you. Yeah? So if I trust you, I will find the explanation for a problem typically outside instead of internal. Moreover, trust is this kind of lubricant that allows you to deal with hiccups. So in that way, it's a very nice lubricant. But we should not be naive. What I've also seen, and I think I often told that to startups that I think are sometimes naive about it. So trust is important and it's valuable, but it's not sufficient to maintain a relationship. So I can trust you, but if I'm not dependent on you, meaning I have nothing from you to benefit from, then whatever trust we have, I will stop the relationship. And it's the same with startups and large companies. So when startups work with large companies, it's good to have trust because it will make the relationship easy. But startups should not be naive. What I've always seen in my cases, the moment the large company no longer needs the startup, because, for instance, they have learned about the technology of the startup, or their strategic preferences have changed and they go into a different direction, the moment that happens, irrespective of the great trust they have, they will dump the startup in the hardest way possible, because there is simply no longer what we call this interdependence. So I think trust is good, but it's not sufficient to sustain a relationship. So I'm always telling to startups, look, if you work with corporates, it's important to build trust, but it's not sufficient. You also have to think about, how can I stay an attractive partner to this corporate? So can I bring in new knowledge? Can I make sure that they stay dependent on me? And that's sometimes a bit more the hardcore technology and the strategy. But I think that's even more important than having trust.
Okay. I've also heard you speak, I think it was in one of your podcast series, about one way of large corporates to work together with startups that you call, or innovation theater. That was the term. No. Which is it's a funny term, but there's a serious meaning behind it.
Yes.
What's that? What's the idea behind it?
No, so innovation theater is a concept launched by Steve Blank, a Harvard professor and entrepreneur. And so what he is mentioning is, like, look, at corporates in the past 10, 15 years have invested a lot in all kinds of innovation hubs, incubators, accelerators, all this kind of innovation boosting activities, often implying collaboration with startups. And what Steve Blank is arguing is, like, yeah, but this is just theater. You know, what would typically happen is that there will be a nice press release about this new innovation hub. It will have a fancy coffee machine and a fancy brick wall layout, and people in hoodies will do a fancy YouTube video. But then after 6 months, if you look at what has actually been produced at these units, the output is kind of depressingly limited. So the impact on the profit and loss account of the company might actually be very limited or mainly negative. And that's what he calls innovation theater. So he's quite skeptical about all this kind of innovation pushing events that corporates do, where he say, yeah, it's just a show, it's just a theater. You might see it as a marketing event, but if you're honest with yourself and you look at the real impact of these activities on the actual cash generation of the company, they tend to be rather limited.
Okay, well, and what would be conditions that are necessary to make it work?
Yeah, and actually, I'm in the process of finishing a paper about that with a colleague in Sweden, Anna Bratström. And so what we arguing is, look, indeed, you see, you might have experienced it. So if you go into corporates and you go into their innovation units, they have to have a very specific layout. There are a lot of kind of cultural manifestations, and even people tend to wear clothes in these specific units that they would never wear in the headquarters. Yeah. So there are all these kind of cultural manifestations within these units that are different from what the corporate normally does. And so we wanted to understand, why is that actually? Why does this happen? And so our kind of conclusion is, actually what these units try to do is to, in the short time, legitimize themselves. So what they want to do is to say, look, we are different. And we allow people to think different here, to act different here, and that gives some legitimacy to the existence in the short term. Because in the short term, these units tend to be unsuccessful. That's also quite normal, because you're doing innovation, that's risky. Typically, these corporates have not done a lot of innovation in the past, so that it fails initially, yeah, that's normal. And so what we are saying is, look, actually, having some theater might be good. because it can give you a certain legitimacy that at least gives you a safe space in the short term to protect this unit against the corporate just slashing non-performance. So in the short term, it might give you a safe space to do something novel, to do something new. But of course, in the longer term, you will need to generate results. Otherwise, it will become this innovation theater that Blank talks about. So we make a bit different difference between in the short term and the long term. So in the short term, we actually believe that doing some theater might be nice because for the people, it gives them the opportunity to be different, to move away from their boring day-to-day job and even give them a kind of escapist experience with some show, and that's okay. But in the long term, of course, results need to happen because otherwise then it becomes just this pure negative theater that will trigger a negative reinforcing cycle and then you will not have the success. But at least in the short term, we see some added value in theater, which is different from what Blank was arguing.
And I mean, there at one point when we come to the cultural element, these startup hubs often also are connected with new work concepts, right? Yeah. This idea of what do I really, really want and self-actualization and that kind of thing. Now, now I would like to hear your skeptical thoughts on that one.
Now, again, so to some extent, I think it's okay that we have people wearing crazy hats in a workshop on agility in these units because we give people a different experience and everybody understands that it's different. So in that way, it can be a nice experience, yeah. But if it only remains that, then of course it becomes very empty and it might actually be demotivating in the end, yeah. So I think this kind of hackathons or design thinking workshops or serious Lego play might be a nice experience and to help people to realize, okay, there is actually a different way of thinking to be entrepreneurial. But then, of course, you will have to really embed that in their day-to-day activities. And because if it's like, oh, for one day, I can do crazy shits in a serious Lego play session, and the day after, I'm back in my cubicle where my procurement manager is saying that I have to send 10 pages for an NDA for whatever, yeah, then this one-day workshop will not have a lot of impact, I think.
Okay. So what I hear you say is protected space is okay and soft factors are okay, trust is okay, but it needs to be backed up by this zest to really produce something tangible that's a real value. And that is something that entrepreneurs typically bring to the table because they don't have a plan B. They don't have a cubicle to go back to. This is their life, right? This is what they do 24/7.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And again, I think I'm always laughing if I go into this kind of innovation units with corporates. And then you see these, and then their innovation hub is this extremely fancy office with the newest Mac computers, a 10,000 euro coffee machine, the nicest furniture. And then I'm always thinking like, so this is how you think a startup looks like. Yeah. And whereas if I go to the WU startups in Berlin that start, they're sitting in the most shitty office in a cellar with no windows. It smells like rotten pizza. They even don't have real chairs. They're sitting on wooden boxes. That's how a real startup looks like, you know? And then we have this corporate that thinks like startups are this kind of luxury islands of fancy Macintosh computers and coffee machines, which I always found quite entertaining.
Oh, great. Dries, I would like to also get to know your story, get to know that a little bit better. So how was little Dries like? Where did you grow up? What were your influences from back home? What led you to this route in life that you've chosen?
So I grew up in Sint-Niklaas, city of 50,000 people in Belgium. I come from a family with a lot of teachers. So I think this kind of educational legacy is in my DNA, I would say. At the same time, I would say from my father's side, it's a bit more focused on mathematics. So I have this kind of mixture, I would say, of the more hardcore mathematics stuff. And at the same time, I think some capability to do storytelling in education, which I think served me well for my professor career. And I think I come from a very traditional middle class family in Belgium. And to be honest, when I came to BAU, I realized that. So if I look at the CVs of our students, what they do even during their education, that they go to these internships, to these fancy companies. They often do a lot of volunteer work. They go abroad for 1 year. They take a gap year. Yeah. And then if I look to my own kind of CV, these are all things that I have never done. I even never thought about, you know. I went to university and I studied there, but I've never done an internship. I've never done this kind of hardcore volunteering work. I've never been abroad. So you then notice that there is a kind of different perspective on building your CV that I was even not aware of when I was a student myself. I was just at a public university following my courses and being quite lazy, I would say. And if I see my current students, all the stuff they do, not just for school, but then also next to that, I'm always like, oh my God, I did not realize that when I was a student myself, that this kind of alternative world exists.
Yeah. And it's almost like there are certain things that you have to have on your CV if you want to make a statement in the world there, in this particular bubble, right?
Yeah. And but so I think it's something to realize that, like, we as a private business school, to some extent, we are this bubble. And I come from outside that bubble. Mm-hmm. And I don't have issues with it, but we need to realize that our students are acting in a specific way. Sometimes I would like to still see more diversity, and I don't mean diversity in terms of gender and nationality. These are things we can address, and we are addressing them. But still, this kind of homogeneity in terms of how should you behave and what should we do? And so these CVs of our students are looking all exactly the same. And yeah, that's sometimes, for me, a bit uncomfortable, let's say it like yeah. that.
And I find, I can see that. And I find that the MBA programs, for example, there the diversity also from the backgrounds in my world is larger, and it becomes even larger in the executive education or post-degree programs. That will be my perspective.
Yeah. But then, okay, but there indeed, we have people from more countries and stuff like that. But I would say their attitudes or what they see as, they are still wearing the same clothes and they are all wanting to do the same kind of internships. So we seem to have this very kind of shared understanding about what does it need to build a career. And then, and to some extent, I think we also learn our students to behave like that.
Yeah.
And I don't have the perfect answer here. It's not, but sometimes I'm a bit like, again, when I do a lot of LinkedIn research, so then I look at all these LinkedIn profiles, and then it's something like, oh my God, it's always the same profile, you know. And, but I also don't have a straightforward solution for it. So
yeah. And Dries, when did the notion or the topic of entrepreneurship come into your life? I mean, you could have become a professor of economics, micro, macro, whatever, but entrepreneurship is very particular in that.
Yes, and this has always been in my career a kind of... there was no strategic thinking going on there. So I did at Leuven, I did commercial engineering. That was my degree. And I was specialized in human resource management, which was actually quite exceptional. I was actually the only one in my year that took that particular direction. So most of them took finance or operations management or strategy. But I was intrigued by human resource management. So I took that choice. But because I was the only one, I also got quite some attention from the professors involved because I was the only one. And then one professor, Luc Sels, who is actually now the rector in Leuven, he encouraged me to do a PhD. So we wrote an application to get some funding. And then I actually got kind of a 1 year funding to start. And so I started doing a PhD on the topic of human resource management for medium-sized companies. But then the funding ran out and we were actually struggling to get funding in the end. And in the end, I got funding on a project on collaboration for innovation. Now, at that point at university, I've never had an innovation course. So it was actually a totally new topic for me. But yeah, because there was 4 years of funding available on that topic, I started my PhD on collaboration for innovation. And then actually some other professors became involved to supervise me. And that's how I got into the topic of innovation. And then afterwards, I was an innovation professor in Twente in Groningen. And then I moved to WAU. So the position was advertised as entrepreneurship. I think it was advertised as entrepreneurship and technological transformation. And I immediately told them, okay, actually, I don't know that much about entrepreneurship. but I know a lot about innovation, and that's very close to technological transformation. And so I even asked them, does it make sense to apply? And they said, yeah, you can apply. And then in the end, I was selected. Then when I was selected, I actually wrote to the dean at that time, yeah, actually, can we add to the title innovation? Because that's actually what I'm doing. And then I said, yeah, that's okay. But please realize that we need you to teach entrepreneurship. And I said, yeah, that's okay. And so actually, when I started at WAU, it was not that I had a lot of experience in entrepreneurship, because I focused mainly on innovation in larger companies. But so in the past 5 years, I started really specializing now in entrepreneurship.
Oh, wow. What a story. Okay. Well, that's interesting. I learned a lot.
So it's quite opportunistic, let's say. Like that.
So, Dries, thank you for taking us through that tour to your work and your life and how you got to where you are now. So what's next? I mean, looking forward, what kind of... what projects are fascinating you? What difference do you want to make going forward?
Yeah, so I don't know. I've really learned not to make a lot of plans and to kind of just wait and see what happens. So in the past year, I've spent a lot of my time on this whole generative AI topic, which 2 years ago, I had no idea that I would become kind of a specialist in generative AI. So this kind of happened by coincidence. But at the moment, I'm really fascinated by the topic. I'm developing actually for WAU now a number of courses in our different programs. So in February, I will do a course in generative AI in our executive MBA. I'm preparing a generative AI course for the online MBA program. So this is definitely something that I now want to follow up and continue. But do I have a kind of 5-year plan looking forward on where I want to be in 2030? No, I have no idea. And I would say my learning has been that making plans in a field like academia is very difficult. It's always a bit like, opportunities do emerge, and sometimes they go nowhere, sometimes they go somewhere. That's actually a discussion that I have with Garrett on our own podcast now quite a lot. Actually, if you compare academics and entrepreneurs, they are very similar in terms of how they work, what they have to do, the level of uncertainty that they are facing. I'm more and more convinced that good entrepreneurs and good academics are actually very similar. And that it's very difficult to plan a trajectory in this kind of environment.
Okay. So that there's this element of being present, knowing what's going on, feeling what's coming up, trying it out, seeing if it goes somewhere, maybe it doesn't, try again, that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just to give you an example, so like in 2020, when we had the corona break, I used a bit of corona break to learn myself again to program to code with Python, because I was fascinated by natural language processing from a research perspective. So I wanted to learn myself again to code. So I did some Python courses online and started using that for my research. And so I spent like 2-3 years trying to develop some advanced natural language processing techniques that I could use in my research. And actually, I learned a lot, but if you look at the output, the academic output, it's zero. So I did not find really a good way to translate these skills into academic research. But given that I had built these skills, when OpenAI launched the ChatGPT, I immediately had a very good understanding about what it was, because it's built on transformers, and transformers was the thing I was using in the past 2-3 years. So I immediately had a very good understanding, okay, this is what you can do with it, this is what you cannot do with it. I was able to embed it into coding because I knew how to code and how to use APIs and stuff like that. So in that way, I think, although you could say I've wasted 2-3 years on something that didn't really produce outcomes, it helped me now to jump on something new and to be in front of these developments, and be able to kind of position myself as quite an expert on this topic. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, kind of the serendipity that you can have in your learning trajectory, where you need to accept that sometimes you spend 2-3 years on something that is going nowhere, but then still it can help you to jump on a new train where there is more potential.
Yeah.
And I think the important thing is not to get too frustrated about it, because it's simply part of our academic life that you need to take risks, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and that you are able to accept it.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, I know that you have 2 kids.
Mm-hmm.
When you turn on the news these days and see what's going on, how do you remain optimistic, or how do you go through your day?
To be very honest, not thinking too much about it. I'm quite pessimistic about where we're going to. I think we will have first to go through major crises before we can, if you compare, like, when we lived in the 90s, the kind of optimism we had about how, in which direction the world was going, and again, not everything was going well, but I think if you compare it now, the whole geopolitical situation, I don't have optimism, but I also myself, I always make a very clear distinction between what we call exogenous and endogenous factors. So there are a lot of exogenous things. There are wars, there is macroeconomic climates, there is geopolitical conditions that will affect my life, and will definitely affect the life of my children. But as a person, I can do nothing about it. So what does it make sense to worry about it if I can do nothing about it? Yeah. So, okay, we will have terrible climate things. We will have wars. I think Europe is in a very bad position geopolitically. We will be treated like shit in the coming decades because nobody needs us. Yeah, so I think that these are likely outcomes, but I don't worry about it because I cannot change them. So I think in my education with my children, I try to focus on things that I can control, on more endogenous circumstances, where I try to give them a nice environment to grow up in, where they experience safety and love. These are the things I can provide them. And okay, if the overall situation doesn't look very nice, yeah, that's something that I think, if I have to give an expectation, I think the next decades will not be the nicest ones, but I cannot change it. So why would I worry about it?
That makes sense. Okay. Well, thank you, Dries. What's the last question is, what's the one thing I haven't asked you yet that could be of interest to our listeners?
Let me think. What didn't you ask me? Maybe something about my hobbies. We didn't talk about my hobbies.
Absolutely. So, Dries, what are your hobbies?
I have to say, but because nowadays I'm much less. Nowadays I do a lot of biking. So I'm cycling with my bike. And in the past, I was a fervent table tennis player.
Oh, okay.
So that's during my, when I was at high school, but even at university, I played easily like 3-4 evenings per week table tennis. So I did.
Oh, so it's competitive.
Yeah. Okay. It was quite competitive, yeah. So we traveled around Belgium to play against other teams, which was also fascinating because then you came into the French-speaking part of Belgium, which we otherwise didn't kind of experience that much. And then it was quite interesting to sometimes see the differences.
And what's your stronger hand?
You only have one in table tennis, so it's,
no, but backhand, I was a right hand.
Ah, yeah, okay. No, forehand, definitely forehand. My backhand was quite lousy.
Okay, Dries. Thank you so much. Thank you for taking us on this tour through your life. All the best to you. And
thanks.
We'll stay in touch, I guess. And I definitely, if I can see a demo on this ChatGPT coach you built, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, the problem is that one is really private because it has all my... but we can talk about, maybe we can make a more generic one that you can see a bit how it can work.
That would be cool. Okay. So that will be for our next session. Thank you so much, Dries. All the best.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. So this was Professor Dries Fams. What are your thoughts? What stuck with you? What are your reflections? Please send us an email or leave us a comment on the portal or the platform that you are listening to this podcast. We are also always very happy to get reviews. And here's our email, leaderstalk@leadership-choices.com. Thank you for listening. Stay healthy. And see you soon or hear you soon. In the next 2 weeks, we'll be publishing our next episode. And until then, bye-bye.